Let's start. Any questions before we start today's lecture? So we are going to pick up where we left yesterday. So what we tried to do yesterday is use the variational wave function, the BCS wave function, and use that wave function to calculate the ground state energy using the BCS reduced Hamiltonian, and then minimize it. And when we minimize the ground state energy, we get this equation. So this equation is the solution. This contains the expressions for UK and VK, which were the variational parameters. Any questions? So this quantity involves theta k here, also involves theta k here. This will be important when later we talk about superconducting gap. So let's make a definition. Let's define delta k as minus sum over k k prime v k k prime times u k prime v k prime. So this is basically minus half sum over k prime v k k prime sine 2 theta k prime. So if you look at this expression, delta k is the sum over k prime of this quantity. The k dependence of this parameter delta that we have just defined only comes from vkk prime. These two only depend on k prime, which is summed over. So with this definition, you can write that tan 2 theta k is minus delta k psi k. Now, this tangent function, from this you can calculate sine and cosine. There's only one tricky part, that is that this tangent is minus. So I can write, so this means that sine 2 theta k, this I can choose as delta k divided by EK cosine 2 theta k as minus psi k divided by EK, where EK is defined as square root psi k square plus delta k square. So this is the tangent function. Using this, I can choose sine and cosine. Note that I've put the minus sign here rather than here. I could have put minus sign here and plus sign here also. The reason for this sine convention is the following. This sine 2 theta k can also be written as 2 times uk vk. And this cosine 2 theta k can also be written as vk square minus uk square. Now we are going to assume that as the energies, so this psi k is epsilon k minus mu. So it is measuring the energies from the Fermi level. As this energy approaches infinity, we expect the wave function to be finite. So we expect this high energy state to be empty. What that means is, as psi k approaches infinity, we expect nk to vanish. Now, we saw that nk, the expectation value of nk in the BCS ground state was, so just the expectation value of nk would give you vk square with a 2. Okay, so let's talk about expectation value in the BCS state. Write down the full expression. So we expect as psi k goes to infinity, vk goes to 0. Now in this expression, if psi k goes to infinity, then you get minus 1. Then vk goes to 0, you have minus quantity here and minus uk square. If I would have chosen a plus sign here, then this constraint would not be satisfied. So that constraint fixes the sign of which sign to put where. Now let's look at this definition again. So we have delta k is equal to minus half sum over k prime v kk prime sine 2 theta k prime. Now we have just calculated this value of sine 2 theta k, so we can put it back in. So we'll find that delta k is same as minus half sum over k prime vkk prime delta k prime over ek prime. Next, to make progress, we would do the same thing that we did yesterday, that is to make an approximation that vkk prime is a constant. So we ignore any dependence of this attractive potential on the momentum. We only keep the fact that it is attractive. So vkk prime is minus v if psi, if epsilon k minus epsilon mu or epsilon f, this is less than or equal to h bar omega c, and also epsilon k prime is less than, and it's zero otherwise. So we discussed that any dependence, k dependence on this delta is coming from vkk prime, which is independent of k and k prime. So that means delta is independent of k, right? So any dependence on k just comes from this matrix element of the interaction potential, which we've assumed to be constant. So in this particular case, I can cancel these delta values, and what I will be left with is 1 is equal to, let's put minus v here. So I will have v divided by 2 sum over k prime 1 divided by square root psi k prime square plus delta square. So I'm now ignoring the k dependence of delta. Any questions? Now we will convert this sum over k prime to an integral over energy, and again make an approximation that the density of states, the energy dependence of the density of states, can be ignored. So this sum over k can be converted to an integral over energy times the density of states, let's call it g. Now, this k prime, this sum over k prime, is going to contribute only when you are in this energy window. So the limits of this integration are minus h bar omega c to h bar omega c. Now, what same as what we discussed yesterday, if I plot this function density of states, I know for 3D I expect some square root dependence. Let's say this is the Fermi energy. Around the Fermi energy, let's call it epsilon F. Around this Fermi energy, there is a window of 2h bar omega c where I expect this interaction potential to be finite. Within this, and we assume that h bar omega c is much less than the Fermi energy. So in this small window, I'm going to ignore the energy dependence of the density of states. I'm going to approximate this function by a constant and its value at epsilon f. And I can also use the fact that once I take this outside, this is a symmetric function. So I will just have to integrate. So I can get rid of the factor of 2 and integrate from 0 to h bar omega c. Any questions? Yes?
Sorry, can you explain again how you canceled the delta on the right side?
This?
The.
And this?
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that delta is independent of k, because from the definition, I see that any k dependence of this delta comes from this vkk prime.
Okay.
And I assume vkk prime does not depend on k or k prime. So by definition, just looking at the definition, I can conclude that delta must be independent of k.
Sure.
So this integration is a sine hyperbolic function. So when I integrate, I get 1 over the interaction potential V times GEF. This is equal to sine hyperbolic inverse h bar omega c over delta.
We convert to integral.
So there is a volume factor when we convert the sum over k to an integral over k. But then there is also a volume factor in the definition of density of states.
Okay, so this is not density of states per volume. I guess it's.
Yeah, so it's density of states divided by volume. So to get the total number of states, you have to multiply that volume factor. Yeah. So from this, what we get is that this gap delta, this can be written as h bar omega c divided by sine hyperbolic 1 over v g times ef. Now, this sine hyperbolic, you can write as exponential 1 over v g EF. Minus e to the power minus VGEF by 2. Now we are going to make another approximation which is also we discussed yesterday, it's ignoring or assuming that this quantity is much less than one. So this is called weak coupling limit. What that means is we can ignore this exponential. So we are only left with this. And we'll get that delta is approximately 2 times h bar omega c and exponential minus 1 over v times density of states at Fermi energy. So EF, I think sometimes I call it epsilon F. What I mean is Fermi energy. Any questions so far? So what we have found is that this delta, again, involves h bar omega c, which is the cutoff for this attractive interaction. And it involves an exponential. In the weak coupling limit, we expect this factor to be very small. So this is very small, 1 over this is very large, divided in the denominator. So a new energy scale has emerged. So we have an energy scale, which is the Fermi energy. We have another energy scale, which is h bar omega c. And now we have a new energy scale, which is delta. These three energy scales are related like this. Electrons at the Fermi energy within a window of h bar omega c see this attractive interaction, and as a result of this attractive interaction we get an energy scale delta which is much smaller than this. Now we will see that this energy scale delta is the quantity that is related to the transition temperature of the superconductor. Any questions? So now that we have calculated delta as this value, what we can do is we can calculate explicitly the values of UK and VK. So we have the following equations. We have VK square minus UK square is minus psi k by ek, and we know that they are normalized, so vk square plus uk square, that's equal to 1. From these two equations we can calculate the values of vk square and uk square. And similarly, UK square is with a plus sign. So once we know these values of UK and VK, we know the BCS wave function. So these were the variational parameters, and we obtained the solution by minimizing the BCS Hamiltonian. And minimizing the Hamiltonian gave us this equation. You can make a plot of Vk and Uk as a function of energy or psi k. So if you make this plot, now we just discussed that as psi k goes to infinity, we expect Vk square to go to zero. So what we find is that below, so let me set, so psi k, so let me make a plot. This is zero, this is plus delta, this is minus delta, this is one. So this is how Vk square looks like. And if I plot Uk square, that would just be one minus of this. So it's not very symmetric, but the main idea is that most of the curve is flat over most range of energy values, but the place where it's not flat is centered around zero, and the domain where it varies is around two delta. So from zero, the energy delta and minus delta. Any questions? So if you really want to think in terms of momentum space, this zero, remember our definition of psi k, this was defined as epsilon k minus mu, or epsilon k minus EF. For all wave vectors greater than kf, we are on this side. For all wave vectors smaller than kf, we are on this side. So this is the solution of the BCS wave function. So we have found the ground state of the superconductor. Now, what can we learn from this ground state? Couple of things already we can explain from this, from what we have just done so far. Now we see that this delta that we found depends on h bar omega c, which is the cutoff for the attractive interactions. And this, because these interactions come from phonons, this energy is related to Debye energy, or the frequency of the phonons. Now, what we can do is, so this is a plot of Vk square at zero temperature. So all these plots, both of these plots, are at zero temperature. They are for the ground state, BCS ground state, or ground state of the superconductor. And by definition, this ground state is at zero Kelvin. If I plot now on the same curve, Fermi function, or what I'm plotting now is Fermi function at Tc. So I, on the same plot, I plot the Fermi function at Tc and I see that that looks very similar to VK squared. So this is an observation. We make the plot of Fermi function, and it also looks very similar to VK squared. But Fermi function is really plotted at a different temperature. It's plotted at TC, the transition temperature of the superconductor. And I'm comparing it with VK squared at 0 Kelvin. Now, this Fermi function, it deviates around a temperature range of KBT. So if I'm plotting the Fermi function at TC, that means the deviation is on the range of KBTC. It matches with VK squared, where the deviation is of the order delta. That means that delta is similar to KBTC. Now, this goes as 2h bar omega c e to the power minus 1 over v g e f. We know the this frequency for phonons. Remember, we found that the frequency for phonons, this goes as square root of k over m sine Ka, find factor of 2 here, and sine Ka by 2. So what we see is that TC depends on this cutoff, which is the phonon frequency, which goes as 1 over square root of the mass of the ions. This explains the isotope effect. So remember, we discussed that in the experiments, they found that TC, it goes as mass of the ion to the power minus half. So just our calculation of UK and VK, and then calculating what delta is, comparing it with the Fermi function at TC, we can deduce that TC, the transition temperature of the superconductor, should scale as 1 over square root of the mass of the ions. Now, so far, we have only discussed the ground state of the superconductor. And by this.
Can you explain how the omega phonon is related to everything else we've done?
So, this omega c, in this approximation, it assumes that the attractive interactions are finite only if the two electrons are within an energy of h bar omega c around EF, around the Fermi energy. And when we calculated the diagram that gives rise to superconductivity, this included this. So we know that this attraction comes is electron is mediated by phonons. So the energy scale during for which this interaction is finite must be the phonon energy scale. Yes.
So are the electrons that are below omega c the ones that are still trapped in the Fermi C, and everything above it are like free Cooper pairs?
So there are no free Cooper pairs.
Yeah.
And as soon as you pair electrons, then there is no Fermi function. They are bosons. So this is slightly tricky. What I'm plotting is just VK square and UK square. And what VK square tells me is the probability that a Cooper pair with relative momentum K is occupied. So what it really tells is that the probability is pretty high for all momentums k till kf. The probability is pretty high. Above kf, the probability is pretty low.
But if you take V to zero, you should get back like the step function, right? For
so this yellow, this orange curve, yeah, that's the Fermi function. UK square and VK square, UK square and VK square, I'm plotting at zero temperature. There is no temperature in these expressions for UK square and VK square. They are already at zero temperature.
Yeah, yeah. I'm saying if you take the interaction strength V to zero.
Yeah. If you take interaction potential V to zero, then yes, it would be at zero temperature, it would be pretty boring. You will have step function here and this there. You can also see it from the following, that if you take the interaction V to zero, this delta is going to vanish. So this interval is shrinking. This h bar omega c doesn't play a role, and you will really get a step function for
but
V and U.
When V is zero, the electrons don't have any negative energy states, right? So it should also shift to the right, kind of.
So when, which curve?
The VK curve.
So VK would more look like everything is one till Fermi energy, VK square, and then it's zero. So what that will, So what that means is all electrons are occupied, but you can't conclude from that these occupied electrons are also paired up. So there are two things. They are occupied, but whether they are paired or not, that depends on the binding energy. So the total energy of the system, if they are not paired, you just have a bunch of electrons below Fermi C, the total energy will be Fermi energy times the number of electrons at the Fermi surface. But if they are paired up, the total energy is going to be much lower. And this is something that is called condensation energy. And in the tutorial today, you would actually calculate this for a BCS superconductor. So the difference, whether the occupied electrons are paired or not, really comes from calculating the total energy of the system and seeing that the total energy is below what you would have expected from just Pauli exclusion principle. So the idea now is that in this theory so far, we have only looked at the ground state. But to do calculations at finite temperature, you need to include excitations in the system. So variational method is good, it's easy. You can guess a state, you can calculate properties of the ground state, but it is not very helpful if you want to talk about excited states. So now what we would like to do is we would like to formulate the theory of a BCS superconductor in a way that we can also discuss excitations above the BCS ground state. So we know a lot about the BCS ground state. Next, we are going to discuss excitations on this BCS ground state. So the approach we are going to take is same as the mean field, is what we discussed for when we did Hartree-Fock. So what we are going to write down the mean field Hamiltonian, we need a mean field parameter. The mean field parameter we are going to choose is this delta k, which is defined with a minus sign. So next, what we are going to do is we are going to calculate the mean field Hamiltonian with this as the parameter. So what we can do is we can define deviation operators, which will be defined as this operator as an operator, the two operators as two operators, minus the expectation value. And we are going to put that in the full BCS Hamiltonian and then ignore the higher order terms in the deviation operator and then finally write down the mean field Hamiltonian. So this is what we did in great detail when we did Hartree-Fock. So now I'm just going to write down the Hamiltonian that I will get. If I use this as the mean field parameter, the Hamiltonian that I will get, let's denote this by mean field, BCS, is going to look like, first I have the kinetic energy. Then I will have a term that has two creation operators. Then I will have a term that will have two annihilation operators. And finally, I will have a term that has expectation values only. Now, this last term is just a constant, so it's not very important. We also ignored this constant when we discussed Hartree-Fock. The other terms are relevant for calculating the excitations, but you can see this Hamiltonian is a bit tricky. Usually, when we write down the single particle terms in the Hamiltonian, we get number operators. We get C dagger C's. Even when we did Hartree-Fock, we had terms C dagger C, and we had other corrections that we said we could absorb by defining a quantity called self-energy. But now it's a bit tricky because we have two creation operators and two annihilation operators. So if you ever see such a Hamiltonian, there is a trick that you can use to diagonalize this. And this is called Bogle-Bov-Volatin transformation. And we can use the same trick. The idea is to write down that Hamiltonian in terms of a matrix. So you can multiply this thing out. You would see that a lot of terms are same as there. You'll get some additional terms. For example, when you multiply everything out, you will get a term C minus K down times minus psi K times C minus K down dagger. But there we have spin terms and in terms of C dagger C. So So you will anti-commute and you'll get a constant one, and that will give rise to this term. I think these constants, they usually would never play a role. The only place where we kept them was when we discussed ferromagnetism. And there, these constants play a role because spin densities can be different. In most other topics where you apply mean field theory, these constant terms can simply be ignored. Yes. So the old delta K that was calculated in the ground state, and in fact so it's not clear at the moment that they are related, but it would be very soon once we find the solution. We would see that actually it would be identical to this one. So these are all just these two terms are just constants. So let me ignore. I can ignore them. And now, what I want to do is I want to diagonalize this Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian, we can write down as sum over k, some vector ak dagger, Hamiltonian hk, ak. Where AK is CK up, C minus K down dagger, and HK is Psi K, Delta K, Delta K star, minus Psi K. So the reason we are doing two different things is because the first thing we did, the variational calculation, only tells us about ground states. And now we want to do a bit better. We want to calculate the excited states, or we want to look at how they look like, what are the excitations on the ground state of the superconductor. And we are doing that within mean field theory. So once we have this Hamiltonian, I can perform a unitary transformation that will diagonalize this Hamiltonian. So I'm going to choose a unitary transformation such that UK inverse is UK, these are small u's, UK minus VK, VK star, UK star. Then I can define new vector BK, which is UK inverse acting on AK. And I can call this new vector BK, which will now be that matrix acting on this vector, will now be our new operators, and we call these new operators gamma k up and gamma minus k down dagger. So I can insert UK dagger here, and same thing here, UK dagger. This UK dagger, AK, UK dagger is UK inverse. This will give me BK. This UK, this will give me BK dagger, and this UK dagger, HK, UK, this quantity in the middle, we want this quantity to be diagonal. So we impose the constraint that this has vanishing of diagonal elements, and it can only have diagonal elements EK and EK tilde. So we have a general, we have written down a general unitary. When we impose this constraint, we can calculate what these UKs and VKs are. And when I do that, I will find that these UKs and VKs are precisely what we calculated in the BCS theory. It's actually, we chose this UK and VK such that we'll find that expression. So what we'll find is UK square is half 1 plus psi k divided by EK, and VK square is half 1 minus moreover, we'll find that EK tilde, and we'll find that EK. So these values are, the eigenvalues are fairly easy to calculate by just looking at this. The eigenvalues are going to be plus minus square root psi k square minus delta k square. So EK, the top eigenvalue, is in fact square root psi k square plus delta k square. EK tilde is going to be minus EK. So if I now write down the new Hamiltonian in terms of gamma operators, what I would write is the following. That H mean field BCS is sum over K. Now I will write gamma K up dagger gamma minus K down. And then I have EK and I have minus EK. So we start with this Hamiltonian. We do a unitary transformation that diagonalizes this Hamiltonian. And this unitary transformation defines new operators, gamma and gamma k dagger. In terms of these new operators, the Hamiltonian looks like this. Now you see there is a gamma k dagger and gamma k term with ek. But with this term, you get gamma times gamma dagger. These gammas are fermionic operators. So we can see that in the following way. What are these gamma operators? They are defined using this equation. So you have gamma k up, gamma minus k down dagger. This is matrix UK minus VK. VK star, UK star, acting on CK up, C minus K down dagger. You can also write down the inverse transformation
So you'll have CK up, C minus K down dagger. UK star VK.
Now we know anti-commutation relation for these C operators. We can write down gamma operators in terms of these C operators and calculate the anti-commutators of these new operators. When we do, we can conclude that these gamma operators are fermionic operators. So what we are doing here is calculating the anti-commutator of gamma k up, gamma k up dagger. If you do this, you'll find that this is equal to 1. This will, when you write down this expression, use the anti-commutators of these fermionic operators, and you can show that this is equal to 1, and all other anti-commutators are 0. So what we have shown is that these operators, gamma and gamma daggers, these are fermionic operators. If you look at the second term, you have gamma minus k dagger. So you can use the anti-commutator and you can get rid of this minus sign. So in terms of gammas, the mean field Hamiltonian is simply sum over k, ek, gamma k up dagger, gamma k up, plus gamma minus k down dagger, gamma minus k down plus constants that we are ignoring. What is the value of this ek? This is square root of psi k square plus delta k square. So what does this Hamiltonian tell us? What this tells us is that to create, so this is number operator for these new operators gamma, and to create one excitation, either of type gamma k up or of type minus gamma minus k down, it costs an energy ek, and this energy ek must be greater than delta square. So this is epsilon k minus mu. This is h bar square k square divided by 2m minus the Fermi energy. This total has to be larger than delta k. So what that tells us is that to create an excitation, I need to pay an energy of more than delta. So that means there is a gap in the excitation spectrum. There are no single particle gapless excitation. So to create a single particle excitation, which will be denoted by gamma k up dagger or gamma minus k down dagger, I must pay an energy greater than delta. So these operators, gamma k up dagger and gamma minus k down dagger, acting on psi g, these create excitations.
And these excitations are called Bogle bonds. Bogle bonds.
Now, in the homework problem, you will calculate this, and you would also show that the annihilation operator gamma k up acting on the ground state, which is the BCS state, is zero, and gamma minus k down acting on BCS state is also zero. What these two equations imply is that there are no Bogle bonds in the BCS ground state. Now, these creation operators, gamma k up dagger and gamma minus k down dagger, if you write in terms of C's, you would see that they are superposition of creation and annihilation operators. So we can just write it down, say the first one. So what we find is that gamma k up is uk c k up minus vk c minus k down dagger. And we want to talk about the creation operator. So let's put a dagger here, star here, dagger here, star here, and similarly, we can find gamma minus k down dagger. That is vk star c k up plus uk star c minus k down. And the second one is dagger. So we can see that these creating a Bogle bond is actually coherent superposition of creating an electron and annihilating an electron also. So the excitations on superconductor, on the ground state of superconductors, are not like the normal electronic excitations. They create an electron and also annihilate an electron. Annihilation operator for an electron can be thought of as a creation operator for holes. So you can think of absence of an electron as a hole. So what this operator really does is creating an excitation on top of a superconductor or on the ground state of a superconductor is like creating an electron and creating a hole with the superposition or the coherence factors given by UK star and VK star. So these UK and VK, they're also called BCS coherence factors for the superconductor. And what that really means is that creating an excitation really means a coherent superposition of creating an electron and a hole. Any questions so far? Yes.
Let me see the group pair. Like the group pair is a two electron, pair of electrons. So if you create an excitation, you break a pair. Technically, shouldn't you create two electrons and two holes?
So there, we have to be slightly more careful here because there are two. The one is the spectrum for Cooper pairs, which is that they don't cost any energy. So when you break a Cooper pair, you don't have to pay any energy cost. So that's a two-particle excitation. So you break a Cooper pair, you create two particles. What we are describing here are single-particle excitations. So this you can think of as what if, so you have the ground state of superconductor. What will happen if you, say, want to add an electron on it? is simply not possible. So what a superconductor, so say you have a superconductor.
Let me draw it abstractly like this.
Everything is paired. Now I want to add, so I want to create a single particle excitation. I want to add an electron on it. So this is not possible, adding an electron. What the superconductor will do, imagine, we'll mostly have conditions where we have a reservoir for particle. Say, imagine this superconductor is grounded. So what superconductor will do is it will take another electron, it will form a Cooper pair, and when it has taken another electron, in response, it will create a hole. So excitations on top of a Cooper pair, on top of a superconductor, are very different from single particle excitations that we have seen so far on top of a Fermi C. So the reason why these operators are funny is you have to remember that typically when we create single particle excitations, we create them in vacuum. So we start with vacuum and we create a single particle. Now, the excitations are these gamma operators, which are combinations of creation operator and annihilation operator, but the vacuum is the BCS ground state. So these operators, they annihilate. This is not true vacuum. This is really the ground state, BCS ground state of the superconductor. So these excitations, it's a bit difficult to think, or it's not easy to think of these excitations with the single particle excitations on top of Fermi C. So let's just change the vacuum. The vacuum is highly non-trivial. In fact, this vacuum is that product state that we wrote down, the BCS ground state. And if this is our vacuum, we have single particle excitation operators, which are given by this. Any other questions? So now we will go back to the question of whether this delta has anything to do with the other delta. So it does, we can see this from this energy excitation values. We can also see this from this definitions of UKs and VKs. When we make the plot, we'll get exactly the same description around delta. There would be there will be some dependence. However, the meaning of delta is more transparent in this mean field description, because this really tells us that this delta is related to the gap in the spectrum. There we were only talking about the ground state, so it was not clear. There we deduced that this delta is related to transition temperature, which is true, which holds still. But now we also know that this delta is related to the gap in the excitation spectrum. So whenever we do mean field theory, we discuss that we must impose the self-consistency criteria. Now, when we are going to do that, we'll get an equation that will be very similar to this equation for delta that we saw up there, which had delta on both sides. So let's do that. So we are going to impose self-consistency constraint. Which means that we defined our mean field parameter as sum over k prime. Expectation value CK prime down so this was our definition of delta K. And what self-consistency condition means is that now we should calculate this expectation value in the mean field Hamiltonian, using the mean field Hamiltonian. Any questions so far? So we are going to do this calculation. It really simplifies if we write these C operators in terms of gamma operators using this. So I'm going to write that down. Check if you agree with it. So we have delta K. This can be written as minus sum over K prime V K K prime expectation value U K prime star gamma minus K prime down minus V K prime gamma K prime up dagger times U K prime star gamma K prime up plus V K prime gamma minus K prime down dagger. So I'm just writing the self-consistency condition, and this is what I get. Now we have deduced that these gamma operators, these are fermionic operators. So this we can see by calculating the anti-commutators of these operators. So we know that gamma square, when it appears, gamma minus K prime down here, and when you have gamma K prime up, these, if you annihilate two quasi-particles, and then you take expectation value, you will get zero. To get a finite expectation value in this mean field Hamiltonian, you must destroy an excitation and then create one at precisely the same momentum. So what that means is that the only non-zero terms from here are going to be minus sum over k prime, v k k prime, u k prime star, v k prime, so other terms drop out just because we cannot have a finite expectation value in the PCS ground state if we have two annihilation operators or so the ground state is defined as no Bogle bonds. You can either create or destroy an excitation on the PCS ground state. So again, the vacuum here is very different from the true vacuum. In true vacuum, if you have an annihilation operator acting on true vacuum, you will get zero. But now we know that this annihilation operator has some creation operator also. So our vacuum is very different. It is the BCS ground state. So we have seen that this K up acting on this is zero by definition. If I write, so this is our definition of vacuum. Now what we are going to assume is that at t equal to zero, so let me rephrase what I wanted to say. So in terms of gammas, this is still going to be zero if we are at t equal to zero. So at zero temperature, there are no excitations in the system. So annihilation operator, gamma k prime up, acting on the BCS ground state is going to give us zero. What we are interested in is calculating the excitation spectrum. What that means is we are imagining now that we are at finite temperature. So at finite temperature, we are going to have excitations in the system. Is that clear? Yes.
What do you actually mean by expectation value? Is it like?
So what I'm going to do, that's a good question. At finite temperature, what I'm going to do is I'm going to replace this by, I'm going to write this as number operator, and then expectation value of number operator, I'm going to replace that by Fermi Dirac distribution function. So I can answer it in the following way. So what I really mean is thermal expectation value. So this quantity, again, you can write as 1 minus gamma minus k prime down dagger, gamma minus k prime down. So you will see that this whole quantity can be written as minus sum over k prime v kk prime uk prime star vk prime times 1 minus expectation value of number operator for this type of excitation and the number operator for gamma k prime up dagger, gamma k prime up. So if this, so what I really mean by these expectation values or these symbols is the average number, the average occupancy of, or the value, average value of the number operator at a finite temperature. These gammas are fermionic operators, so the quasi-particles or the excitations that these gamma operators are describing must obey Fermi statistics. Moreover, we know that the excitation spectrum of gamma k up and gamma minus k down, they have the same excitation spectrum. So they both actually can be described by the same Fermi function. So I can write this as minus sum over k prime vkk prime uk prime star vk prime 1 minus 2 times the Fermi function ek prime. Now again, I'm going to make an approximation where vkk prime, so we've already written it down. Vkk prime, I'm going to make this on-shell approximation. So it's finite and it's minus v only if the energies epsilon k and epsilon k prime are within an energy window of h bar omega c around the Fermi energy. And again, I will convert the sum over k, over momentum, to an integral, first an integral in k, and then in an integral in energy. And again, I'm going to use the approximation that the density of states around a window of h bar omega c can be replaced by a constant. If I do all these approximations, I can write down this expression as following. Delta K divided by V times G EF is equal to minus H bar omega C to H bar omega C So this NF denotes the Fermi function. Now, when we make this on-shell approximation, we can deduce that delta is independent of k. If delta is independent of k, I can drop the k dependence, and this cancels with this. This quantity here, this is basically 2 divided by, so now I'm putting in the explicit form of the Fermi function. It's e exponential beta times the energy chi square plus delta square plus 1. 1 minus 2 divided by this, you can see that that can be written as tangent hyperbolic beta square root chi square plus delta square divided by 2. This factor of 2 cancels because everything is symmetric inside, so we can do only the integration from 0 to h bar omega c. Now, in the tutorial today, you're going to work with this equation. So this equation is called the BCS gap equation. This is an integral equation. What it tells, it's an equation that involves integral over energy. And from this equation, you can solve or you can obtain the value of the superconducting gap delta as a function of temperature. So delta does not depend on K, but delta depends on temperature. And the temperature is in this beta. So what we can do next is so let me read this equation. So it's 1 divided by V times density of states at the Fermi energy is equal to an integral from 0 to h bar omega c, integral over energy, tangent hyperbolic of beta times square root of chi square plus delta square divided by 2 divided by square root chi square plus delta square. Now this equation you can solve numerically as a function of t. So if you solve this equation involves delta and temperature t. You can solve this equation, and what you will find is that delta as a function of T normalized by its value at 0 temperature will start from 1 and will go to 0 at transition temperature TC. So you can solve this equation numerically, and the solution looks like this. At TC, this curve goes as square root. This is typical of mean field transitions. You probably saw this in the statistical mechanics course. When you have a phase transition that is described by mean field theory, the dependence on the transition temperature goes as square root. if you try to calculate, so in the problem in the tutorial today, you will start with this gap equation, the BCS gap equation, and you will derive the expression for the temperature dependence of delta near TC. What you will find is that delta as a function of temperature normalized by its value at zero temperature is approximately 1.74 times 1 minus T divided by TC square root. So this square root dependence, what we discussed, comes from the mean field nature of this transition. By definition, at TC, delta is zero. So this phase transition is described by an order parameter, which is delta. So above TC, you have the normal phase where delta is zero. So when you calculate this expression, in the BCS gap equation, if you put T equal to TC, that means you can set delta equal to zero. So you will show this in the tutorial today. This expression is valid around TC. At TC, delta is zero. So just around TC, delta is going to be small. And in the tutorial today, you can expand around this, around the value of zero. Exactly at TC, delta is zero. So we can put that in this equation. So in the gap equation, put for temperature TC and delta to be zero. That equation you can solve. And what you would calculate is that KBTC is approximately 1.13 h bar omega c e to the power minus 1 v g e f. So my printing is a bit small, and I think I would blame that on that board over there. Let's hope it's fixed tomorrow. Just ask me whatever you cannot read. So this expression, what is this 1.13? 1.13 just comes from that integral. It's actually 2 times e to the power Euler constant gamma divided by pi. When you will do today's tutorial, you would also find this number halfway through the calculation. So now what we can, another thing we can do is we can calculate the same, you can look at the BCS. Now let's look at the BCS gap equation at T equal to zero. Now at T equal to zero, look at that exponential factor. That is going to diverge. So at T equal to zero, the integral, the BCS gap equation looks like this. So I've put a delta naught here to denote that this is really the value at T equal to zero. Now this integral we have seen already before. This is sine hyperbolic. So I obtained this equation by setting temperature to be zero in that Fermi function. So as a result, I can now calculate this, and I will find that delta naught is 2 h bar omega c, and then exponential 1 divided by
the attractive interaction V multiplied by G EF.
So now, after doing all these computations, and some of this you would see in detail in the tutorial today, I can calculate a quantity delta naught divided by KBTC, which is simply 2 divided by 1.13, which is equal to 1.764. Now, this is a quantity that does not include any parameters of the theory. What it says, what BCS theory predicts, is that when a material goes through the superconducting transition, measure the temperature, that will give you KBTC. Cool the sample down further, as far as you can, you would obtain a dependence something like this. At some point, you will see that the value of the gap is saturating. Measure that value. So this is at t equal to 0. You can measure these two values in the experiment. And BCS theory predicts that this number should come out to be 1.764. When you do the experiments, you find that for tin, this number comes out to be 1.73. For lead, this comes out to be 2.145. For indium, this comes out to be 1.815. There are many materials. Usually, their values will be spread between 1.5 and 2.25. And most of the materials have this ratio around 1.764, the BCS value. So this theory agrees extremely well with the experiments, and it describes the phenomena of superconductivity in a very general way. So this is one of the successes of the BCS theory, that it fits very well with the experimental data. Any questions so far? So the details of how to solve the BCS gap equation will become clear after the tutorial today. From the solution of this gap equation, we can actually verify that the theory agrees with the experimental data. So we have so far already discussed a bunch of things that we can explain that we saw in the experiment, for example, the isotope effect. We can explain using the BCS theory. We can also calculate all these quantities, and they agree very well with the experimental measurements. Also, using this, just the philosophy of pairing of electrons, you can understand why you have zero resistivity. Typically, when you have flow of electrons giving rise to some current in a material, say metal, you have a finite resistance. Where this resistance comes from is basically scattering of electrons. So electrons are carrying current, they are scattered by other electrons, they are scattered by ions, they are scattered by impurities, and all other things. Now, you don't have single electrons carrying current. You have paired electrons, and this pairing happens because by pairing, the system is lowering its energy. So you have paired electrons, which are now bosons. So all of these paired electrons are going to make a Bose-Einstein condensate. So they are all going to be described by a single macroscopic wave function. And now, if you want to scatter one electron, that means change the momentum of one electron, you have to change the momentum of all of these electrons, which are in the Bose-Einstein condensate, which are described by the same macroscopic wave function. Now, this is simply too hard. So the current will flow without any resistance. So the theory of superconductivity we have presented here. It explains almost all of the features that we wanted it to explain. And we have a good understanding of what the excitations in the system are. All of this theory is for what is called now conventional superconductivity. So what, how did we arrive at the, in the very first discussion of superconductivity, we started with Cooper pairs. And what we discussed is a symmetry of wave function at r with, at some coordinate r and spin sigma, two electrons, and the other electron at r prime and spin sigma prime. This wave function, we could write it as a product of wave function in real space, which is dependent on r minus r prime, and some function in spin space. We discussed that if we want the interactions like we had, which are the phonon-mediated electron-electron interactions. For these short-range interactions, the only way we are going to get a sign change for a two-electron wave function is if we choose this function to be symmetric. So the sign change comes from the spin part. So the a wave, if this wave function describes, so we are now talking about wave function of a single Cooper pair. If this wave function describes two electrons, then if I exchange these two electrons, I must get a minus sign. So that means that r prime, sigma prime, r sigma, this should be minus of psi r sigma, r prime sigma. Right? So this sign change can either come from F or it can either come from sigma. For the short range interactions that we discussed, why I'm calling it short range? Because in this approximation on shell, we assumed VKK prime is a constant. So we know that Fourier transform of a delta function is a constant. So typically it's not going to be constant. So it's not going to be delta function in real space, but it is going to be short-ranged potential. For a short-range potential, you would get the superconductor like the one we described here, which basically means that this function f, r minus r prime, is same as f r prime minus r. So the function f is symmetric under exchange. The spin function, the spin part of the wave function is a singlet that when you exchange the two particles, picks up a minus sign. The spatial part of the wave function can be described by another quantum number that tells you the symmetry of how the wave function looks like in real space. This property that the spatial part is symmetric is satisfied by a bunch of quantum numbers. So let's label the spatial part of this wave function by some quantum numbers, labeling it by L. Think of this L as wave function in real space. In analogy with the orbitals of hydrogen atom, you can label this L, you can think of this L as 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. Zero would be S-type wave function, so L can be zero. This S-type wave function has this property. P-type wave function is odd. That gives you a minus sign if you exchange. Then you have two. Both L0, 2, 4, and all even numbers have this property, while
all the odd numbers are going to have this property. So if we allow for the superconductor to take different forms of wave functions, I must allow that it's possible, allow for some other interaction to be, which could be responsible for pairing electrons. So we discussed that if we have short range interactions, what we will get is L equal to zero. So what we discussed so far is also called S-wave superconductor, which comes from here, L equal to zero. And all most of the conventional superconductors that we see in the labs, they are, in fact, S-wave superconductors. You would do a homework problem that will involve what is called D-wave superconductor that corresponds to L equal to 2. For all of these even numbers, the spin part must get a minus sign when you exchange the two electrons. There is another whole branch of possibilities, which is if the negative sign comes from this function itself. Now, you remember when we argued that we want a bound state of two electrons. If we have this constraint, that would mean that the wave function must vanish at origin for small values of this relative coordinate. Now, this is very similar to what we see in p-wave orbitals for hydrogen. So the wave function vanishes at origin, but it is finite away from origin. This L equal to 1 is called p-wave superconductor. So this is called S-wave, p-wave, d-wave, f-wave, and so on. So there is a whole series of superconductors depending on the symmetry of the Cooper pair wave function. In the tutorial on Thursday, you would do a problem with p-wave superconductors that are important if you have spinless superconductor. So if the sign change comes from the spin part, then you must pair upspin with downspin. Imagine if you don't have spin in the problem at all. So you cannot get a sign change from this. So the sign change must come from the spatial part. So you must have this property. So you must have the lowest possible case is, or the highest symmetry possibility of pairing is to have a p-wave superconductor. And this p-wave superconductor has some interesting properties. It can give rise to some bound states, which are non-abelian. They're called Majorana fermions. And you would just, you will do a homework problem on Thursday that you will calculate the operators describing these excitations in the p-wave superconductor. Any questions? So tomorrow we are going to start with the quantum Hall effect. If you have any questions, you will have a tutorial today and also on Thursday on superconductivity. Ask tomorrow morning if you have any questions about what we have covered till now.